Kuchen nicht gut behandeln hasse. This nicht gut means not respectable would be, but somebody worthy of respect, I guess, like covered.
Hakeil hanichbad vehanoira hazeh. This nichbad means not respectable would be, but somebody worthy of respect, I guess, like kavod. Vehanoira and fierce. Well, it's on the second page. No, it's no 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 base. It's no no. It's the second sheet. You have the other sheets. It's
Okay. It's
the other sheets. Says, this God that is respect worthy, Vanora and the fearsome, mitzvah la'ahavo u'liyira mimenu. It is a mitzvah to fear him and to love him and to fear him. Shenema, like it says, v'ahavta es Hashem alakecha. One place it says, v'ahavta Hashem alakecha. V'nema es Hashem alakecha tira. So you have one passage that commands you to love God, and one person commands you to fear God. Now, the Rambam here is going with a certain hierarchy. He started out with the mitzvah of belief in God and the prohibition to deny and have other gods. One. Then he said the mitzvah to make God one. Now he says to love God and to fear God. But he says it's very interesting. He says, this God who is fearsome and respect worthy, we are commanded to love him and to fear him. What he's beginning to say is that God is now perceived with two of our emotions. Just like if let's say we have an object that's too big for us to encompass with one hand, and we put two hands around it, Hashem has to us two facets, a facet that evokes a tremendous attraction and a facet that evokes a tremendous awe. Repulsion, not because of ugliness, but repulsion out of awe and fear.
Are you using awe and fear?
Interchangeably, correct, okay. Correct. Because awe implies a sense of fear out of respect and overwhelmed rather than physical danger. The word fear would mean physical danger, and the word awe would sooner mean the presence and greatness and so on. So he's saying God has two facets, as if, you know, a computer has two ports for output. You know, it's got a serial port and it's got a parallel port. God, he said before, has different ways in which he manifests himself. The two major ways are command provoking and fear provoking. Respect provoking and respect in the sense of love. Now, the place where the Rambam gets the word kavod being similar to love. It says, "Kabed es avicha zimecha," respect your father and mother. And it says, "Es avicha zimecha tira," you shall fear your mother and father. And Rashi says, the reason why it's written like that, Rashi brings a Gemara, is love is more naturally evoked towards a mother. So that's why the Torah says the father first to tell us it should make no difference to you. Fear is evoked by a father, and therefore the Torah says the mother first to tell me again it makes no difference. They're both equally have to be held in awe and be respected. So God is termed as someone who is to be respected and to be feared. One more point about it. Two more points. First of all, the Rambam puts it together in one halacha. I mean, these are two separate dinim. There's two separate mitzvahs. There's a mitzvah to love God, and there's a mitzvah to fear God. The Rambam packages it. This tremendous, awesome God, we're commanded to love and to fear Him. And we will see soon in the Rambam, the next halacha, that they are actually two sides of the same coin. That's point two. One more point. It is seen in a lot of the Sefarim, and the Zohar says that fear and love are the two wings, to quote this language, through which the Shekhinah soars, or something like that. Through which prayers soar up to the Shekhinah. Basically, what it seems to mean is, and the Tanya speaks about it a lot, that the connection between perception and activity is through the emotions. In other words, if somebody comes along and tells me he needs money for tzedakah, and I give him tzedakah, so if I do it very apathetically, so then I've done the mitzvah, yes, I've done it. I guess I know that this person should be given tzedakah. I believe him that he's poor and he needs money. But if there's no feeling in it, the giving and the thinking didn't really connect in any way. There is no, it's not, if I can say, I gave it to being cognizant of the fact that he's poor. I gave it to him because he applied, he fits the criteria, and I gave it to him. Emotions are the bridge between your understanding and your doing. So if a person feels, if it really dawns on them, this person doesn't have what to eat tonight, and I give it to him out of that genuine feeling, that is the bridge between seichel and between deed, between understanding and deed. So fear and love are not two mitzvot just high and dry like lulav and shofar and tzedakah and tkiyas shofar. They belong in Yesod HaTorah. Yesod HaTorah deals with no particular mitzvah but fundamentals of the Torah as a whole. So we're not dealing with if fear and love are distinct mitzvot and not a central element in our perception of God, then this would not be the place for the Rambam to put it in. The fact that the Rambam put it here means he understand it. It's to convey to us it's part of our understanding of what God is. We understand with our minds, we understand He's one, and we understand it with our hearts in Av and in Yira. That's really the way the Rambam here is setting it up. So we have two mitzvot, Av and Yira. There is, before we go further, let me put another Nekuda in. A lot of the Sfarim, early Sfarim, later Sfarim, that speak about this, about Av and Yira, divide up Av and Yira into two types. This is elementary, I'm sure you've heard it. They divide love because the person does good for you, somebody who treats you well and helps you and so on. So it's kind of gratitude. Then there's a higher love, which is not because of gratitude, and maybe we'll try to express later, we'll try to phrase it more accurately. And fear is very famous. There's a fear because you might get punished, and there's a fear because you're overawed by somebody. Those are, and the words used are, there's yiras ha'onesh, fear of punishment, and yiras ha'romus, fear of his greatness, which would be like the nervousness you have when you meet somebody who's very big and you're just overawed by the person. Okay, so let's see the Rambam, and then we'll talk about it later. V'heichi haderech la'avosol yirasei. What is the way in which a person can fear and love him? Obviously, you can't tell me specific things to do. We're not talking about a specific mitzvah like putting on tefillin. We're talking about evoking feelings, which there is no way you can't just command feelings to be evoked. You've got to give me a methodology to evoke them. So he doesn't say, how does one love and fear God? What is the act of loving and fearing? But rather, he's asking himself, what is the method that a person uses to evoke love and fear? So the Rambam says here a hauntingly beautifully picture. B'sho'a she'yizbonein ha'odom b'maisof u'bruov ha'nifloyim ha'gdoilim. When a person looks around and sees the awesome handiwork of God, v'yira mehem chachmaso she'ein la'erech v'lokeitz, and he becomes aware of God's wisdom, which has no equivalent nor any bounds. Miyad hu ohev u'mishabeach, he immediately becomes enamored and he praises u'mifayer. He also praises u'misave taiva gdoila leida shema gadol, and he's filled with a tremendous passion to understand God. Kamo she'amar David, as David said, tzama nafshi l'elokim, my soul thirsts for God, l'keil choy, for the living God. U'kashemechashe b'dvorem ha'elu atzman, and as he thinks of these things themselves, as he's thinking this, miyad hu nirta lachorof, he is immediately taken aback, v'yira, he becomes scared, v'yifached, and frightened, v'yodea, and he realizes, shehuberya ktana, he's an infinitesimal being, shfela, low, afela, dark, omeid bedas kala meuta, standing with a very, very light mind, lifnei tumim deis, before the perfect of all knowledge knows. Kmo she'amar David, as David said, ki eres shamecha, I look around at your heavens, mo enosh ki siskrena, what is man that you remember him? So the Rambam here says, and we'll try to explain, Ava is the reflection on God's greatness, and Yira is the reflection on God's greatness. And he also puts it together. He says Miyad, immediately he's cast. There's something about it that the Rambam is connecting it very, very strongly for us. He says immediately as he's thinking this. And it is the reaction. Let's say we meet somebody that we're really inspired by, or somebody that we look at as great, as overwhelmingly great. You have a mixture of both feelings. You're as nervous as anything because on the other hand, you're very attracted to it. You really would like to get to know the person, you like to understand the person. So the feeling of being scared and attracted at the same time are not things that we're not familiar with. The reason why it has to be like that, I mean, the reason why that's the primary way of Avanira, I think, is because of things that we said before. The Rambam, we explained before that the knowledge that God is all-encompassing and the knowledge that there's nothing but God, even though one is a mitzvah essay and one is a los essay, we said they are two sides of the same coin. This is what he is and this is what no one else is. It's just like one of those pictures you know, where you can define it by what's inside and what's outside, you know, the white and the black, the goblet with the face. The knowing of what God is and that everything else is not is one and the same. It's just like I can resolve certain problems, I can prove certain things by showing the impossibility of any other answer. You know, I can eliminate any possibility and be left with the right answer or the opposite. So the most elementary, our most elementary perception of God, on the one hand, splits into two. It's the knowledge that God is all-encompassing and the understanding that nothing else is real but God. It's the same thing on the emotional level. When we're talking about the most basic emotional grasping of God, it is the ultimate in the sense that I am overwhelmed and consumed by it. I'm very attracted by it. So fear and love is one and the same. It's two sides of the same coin. And like we experience, anytime you've met a person, I mean, besides the person goes out with someone, dates someone, and if the person is very excited, you also have the same mixed feelings. Except there, you're just nervous. I guess the person will say no, but under normal circumstances, there's always a mixture of that, you know, being very impressed with the person and really wanting the person and you know, being kind of taken a little overwhelmed. Let me add a nakuda here. First of all, the Rambam puts it all in the mind. And this itself was not a davar pashut. It's not as simple. There are many Rishonim who like to attack Ava, like to approach Ava as coming from the heart. They say, imagine somebody who showers love on you and who constantly does you favors. One of the reasons why people like their parents so much is because they've gotten so much from them, rather than particularly that they may be overawed by their tremendous being. So a lot of Sfarim, a lot of Rishonim take that approach, that the loving of God comes from how much favor He's bestowed. He's given you existence, He's kept you alive, He's so much Hashkacha. That's one approach. The same thing in Chassidish Sfarim, the Baal HaTanya himself uses almost the exact words that Rambam described love and fear. What's interesting is he starts the other way around. He starts with fear first. He says it almost the words as the Rambam, but he starts with the being overwhelmed and then being immensely attracted by it, which is interesting. But a lot of other citizens felt that was not the right way. The right way was to just evoke emotions as emotions. But in Rambam, it's very important. It seems to be that it's a bridge from the understanding coming out. One more point about the Ava. There is the Mefarish brings it on the side. There is something, the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, that Ava Hatluya Bedover is Sofel is Batel. Any love that depends on something is going to disappear. But Ava Sheinet Tluya Bedover, love that does not depend on anything, is will last. Now, it's very not clear, and it brings, it says about Amnon and Tamar, that was a love that depended on something, the Mishnah says, and that became a hatred, whereas Jonas and David didn't depend on anything, and that stayed, and so on. How exactly do you say a love that doesn't depend on anything? I hate the words. The words that I find the most irritating are unconditional love. Unconditional means meaningless. It's another way. I mean, if a person knocks on the door and says, love me unconditionally. So, what do you mean? It for no reason? There used to be a joke when I was a kid that a hippie once asked his girlfriend if she loves him. And she said, sure, I love the whole world. You know, what does it mean, unconditional love? I mean, the guy, the person... has no redeeming features about him. He's stupid, he's nasty, and he's ugly. And poor, worst of all. Yeah. And he's a poor. Yeah, that really... No, I've never met any ugly, stupid, nasty, wealthy people. So it's all automatic and included in the... I hate to go off the size of it, there's a piece in Nusach Sfarat, the Machzorim, it says that at Kedusha, they bring from that result, you can be mispalel on Kedusha and Musav and Rosh Hashanah Kippur, you can daven for one of three things: successful children, Ruach HaKodesh, or wealth. So somebody's saying, so it's a very, very hard choice, so someone said he's mispalel for wealth. He says, because if I'm rich enough, they'll say my kids are successful and have Ruach HaKodesh. You know, that covers all. So anyway, getting back, what does it mean, unconditional? What does it mean, love that is conditional on something, not conditional on something?
But aren't we really talking in a relationship or in other things, even our approach to Yiddishkeit, that sometimes you start off being attracted by certain tangible things,
right,
and in the course of developing intimacy with that individual or something else,
or the or an ideology,
that,
right?
That eventually that intimacy is no longer dependent on the initial things that attracted you to that. In other words, you found your wife marvelously attractive when she was 20. Maybe she's not as attractive when she's 65.
Right.
But now you have a love for her, where perhaps if you weren't attracted initially, you never would have gotten to that
intimacy. True. Very true. It's definitely... what you're saying, I just want to sharpen the point that I think you're making. When we say, I like a person for things... tluya b'dava, ain't tluya b'dava. Every person comes in different layers of... being, in other words, money being the outermost layer. He happens to have money, he could not have money. So money is beauty is a second layer. Charm and wit and things like that is a third layer. Academic brains and things of that nature, a fourth layer. Let's say pure goodness and real goodness would be, let's say, a fifth point. The further, the more outside I've if it's possible to strip away the money and you have the person still there, so then basically you latch onto the money and not the person. If it's the outside beauty and that gets stripped away, so then you don't have the person. The closer you get to the core of the person, if your connection to the person is to the core of the person, then at that point it won't become bottle. Because it's not exterior to the person. I mean, God forbid somebody who's a very, very good person. I was attracted because of the real quality of a human being. And now he's in a coma. So basically, fine. So there's nothing left to the person. But it's not possible for him to still remain a human being and not be good. He could start losing his beauty. At some point, he could start losing even, if I just wanted it, just his witty saying and his sharp demeanor. So that could be taken away also, and then I'm left with nothing. But if I struck home to the core of the person himself, that's the last thing to go, is the core of the person. So if I'm looking for the same thing as a love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if I were to associate it with things that he did for me, with the interaction, those are still exterior. I mean, God will never stop being good to me, but it's exterior to the innermost, quote-unquote, self that I could possibly touch base with. And therefore, if I go through a hard point, it's not going to take me, because at this point, God's mercy and kindness seem to have spent itself. So what I'm looking for is to relate to God with the innermost quality that he reveals in the world, which is his awesome chachmah and knowledge and so on. So the Ava is building itself, going to the Rambam, the same thing Baal Tanya and much later generations, it's building around God's wisdom, which is the core of anything that was revealed in this world. Anything beyond that, just not here. I mean, any wisdom or chachma is really where it starts, and the awareness of that awesomeness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's as close as the root as I can get in this world. That's it. So the Rambam says perceiving that is the closest way to get the core of what is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's where I'm actually latching on to what is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the first point is I'm latching on to the point that is centermost or deepest or most rooted of all of God's revelations, and that is Chachmaso Yisparach, is wisdom. Secondly, the feeling of love is that I wish to become part of it. It's something that I really feel a desire towards. And if I don't feel, since understanding God is the only real way I can touch base, there's no tangibility and there's nothing I can touch, and God's gifts to me are not predictable. So understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is really the medium through which I can get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is very much around the Shita. Again, not everybody agrees 100%, but the Rambam Shita is very strong in that understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the strongest way of touching base of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So loving HaKadosh Baruch Hu means being tremendously attracted to the understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his ways. Yeah.
Is he saying here, when you look at the world, is he taking an approach in a sense of being, at least initially, as being a scientist? Or is he saying to look at Torah and the wisdom of Torah? I mean, what?
There's
two approaches in some sense.
It's interesting. You will see later on. He says, later on, meaning like the next halacha. So, he says, being that this is so important, I'm going to reveal to you some of God's tremendous, some of the worlds and so on. And what he does is he starts with HaKadosh Baruch Hu created this world and this world, and he goes through different types of angels and so on. So Lemaisa, the Rambam does seem to feel it's the deeper understanding of the world, now, which is somewhere between Torah and the world around. In the Rambam's understanding also, this and metaphysics and physics were part of the same science. So understanding the inner essence of the four elements and the angels and the different celestial spheres, it kind of overlaps. So it's hard to get a sense of, for us, that it is kind of split. Then the Rambam Shita, I'm explaining to you what the Rambam Shita is. Our understanding would be as follows, that in wisdom itself and in knowledge itself, there is also outside and inside. For instance, Kabbalah is called, in the realm of Torah, Chachmas Pnimius, the inner understanding. Just like the in science, let's take an example in science. In science, the observation of phenomena is the outside, and the formula, the equation, is the inside, and the principle behind the equation is the inside of that inside. So you've got three layers. Even science, the apples falling all around is outside. That's the outermost law of gravity. The mathematical formula that tells you what g is and that second squared is that's a more inner characterization of the law, and the understanding why it's that number and why it's squared per second would be an even deeper point to it. So we say to ourselves, all of science. And that's why it's called Chachma Chitzonios. It's an outside wisdom, because none of this is an end to itself. God's real purpose in the world was to create beings who were choosing right and wrong and acted out in a world with a vast amount of possibilities. He needed different laws to do it with, and law of gravity is one of those laws. But the real understanding is that everything about the human being, how he acts, how he goes, how he walks, how he thinks, all that is really, so Torah law is seen as being kind of intrinsic to it, and Kabbalah, let's say, would be intrinsic to Torah. But it's not, you obviously cannot obviate the Chochmah of the world around. Someone told me, my wife's great aunt passed away about 3-4 years ago. Her name was Rebbetzin Edelman. She was in the mid-90s, and she was related to the Chazon Ish by marriage. Her brother married the Chazon Ish's sister. So she was always closer. And she once told over, I mean, she told over many times, it's printed, but I heard it from her, that somebody once brought in a bunch of flowers and put it in a vase on the Chazon Ish's table. The Chazon Ish sat down and he started looking at each petal. And finally she said he had an overwhelmed look, and he said, please take it away from me, I can't anymore. Like Chazon Ish had a very analytical mind and a very poetic neshama, and looking and beginning to see how a flower works and how it draws up water and how it opens up and so on and so forth. He just, you know, so definitely a person is turned on by all these things. You know, a person studies human body, and at some point the person gets up and says, you know, it's incredible. It's incredible, and it's overwhelming, and it's you know, just I read an article. It wasn't printed recently. It was printed somewhere in the 70s or 80s. I have it photocopied because I thought it was one of the most astounding things I ever read. It was an article printed in an Israeli magazine called Mada, which is. It was published by Mahon Weizmann, and it was kind of like Scientific American. It had a broad range of general scientific articles of interest to a science oriented layman or cross discipline. The graphics, the chrome wasn't anywhere. It was not anything. But the articles were actually written well. They were written well. They explained well. I enjoyed it. I used to get it until it folded, until the government stopped sponsoring it, and. They had an article by a botanist who mapped out the interaction between figs, which are the botanical family of Picus, P-I-C-U-S, I think, something like that, and bees or wasps, certain wasps, that they, the fertilization and the reproduction cycle of the wasps and the trees are interrelated tremendously. What happens is, first the flower is open, and then the female wasp lays her eggs on different follicles. Now, there are short. If they lay on all follicles, the thing would dry out and die. So there are long and short follicles. She can't reach the short ones because she can only hover over the long ones. It doesn't long. Then the flower closes up, and that allows it to hatch. Then it fills up with carbon dioxide as it's ripening and opens up. And this is the whole, and each one is specific to it. An awesome article. And I have it. I keep trying to want to translate it to English. It's not long. It's about 4 pages. And it's a marvelous 5-step cycle. The two are interrelated. At the end, he says, I can't finish this article without quoting my professor. And the quote is, there is no end to the wonders of evolution. Now, I was astounded by it. First of all, science doesn't get you an emotional high. That belongs to religion. You should just say, we've just finished describing Phylum Picus and Zehu. This whole Hispilus. Secondly, evolution is not supposed to be marvelous. It's supposed to be simple. You know, the idea of evolution is that things will form the simplest pattern because things survive a lot better when it's a one-step reproduction than a five-step interrelated with another species. I mean, it's the worst possible way to reproduce is if you'd have to go through five different stages and the hispilos of it, I was astounded but at any rate, the hispilos of the world around is definitely Avos Hashem. But understanding that this is so much chachma there and so much, the awesomeness of it, that the person is overwhelmed by it and would like to be able to touch on it and would like to be able to understand it, that's definitely Ava. On the other hand, if a person really, the difference is between between the believer and the not-believer is not only the Ava, the not-believer also would like to explore this wonderful wisdom. But he's not awed by it. This is an accident. In other words, if it's an accident, I mean, which evolution is, it's an accident where things just follow along a certain record. So the word awe doesn't make any sense. I mean, no one thought of it. It just happened. So how can I be overawed by somebody? Yira is the... And one of the things that always stood out, I would say, between Chochmei HaTorah and Chochmos Olam, anybody in the academic world who is really good at it is very enthusiastic about the work he's doing. I mean, obviously. But very few people are humbled in that sense. You know, it's the more knowledge I have, it usually tends to make me arrogant because I know a lot more than anyone else does. Why should I be humbled by the knowledge I have? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, you know, no one thought of this bee fig thing. The bees didn't think of it, the figs didn't think of it. There was no God to think of it. So I'm the smart guy who figured out what's going on over here, that the bees don't understand, the figs don't understand, and no one's informed me. So it's definitely a reason why I should feel good about myself. But if I realize there's somebody who put the system in, so it's a very humbling experience. The pasuk says Reishis Chachma Yiras Hashem, that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God, or it says what wisdom put as its crown, humility became its heel piece. In other words, thanks. Okay. Yeah, that's it. The fact that a person, if his understanding is an understanding of God, then it becomes a very overwhelming experience. So Av and Yira are the same experience. Perceivings, and that's why in a Torah world, anyone who was seen to be Talmid Chacham, but was felt that he was haughty or arrogant, never was considered a gadol. It just didn't go, because people felt the person is not seeing God's Torah in it. Rabbi Kivega was one of the giants of the Achronim, one of the most brilliant of the Achronim. His humility in every line that he writes, I mean, his questions and his points are the sharpest by far, except for the Vilna Gaon. Rabbi Kivega's questions and points are, but they are all, I mean, his humility, the way he writes it, and it's very ineffective when he says, and in my poverty, I have not been able to understand this point. That's why, you know, God should only open up my eyes and enlighten me, because in my shallowness, I have not perceived, or something like that. You know, there's a certain sense of it. Those things are only possible if there's somebody behind it. If I'm looking at someone who's put that Chachma Seichel in, so the desire to be close and to be part of it and be overwhelmed by what it means that someone's done it, that's only possible.
In relation to relationship to the being that created it,
yeah,
it's very easy to be humble.
Your
relationship
right.
to the men, women that you're competing with, it's very easy to be arrogant.
Right. You know? But it's more than that. If someone created it, the more I understand that itself, the source of my understanding and the increase in the increment of understanding I have, evoke both. They evoke a tremendous pull, and they evoke a tremendous sense of overwhelming. They do go together. That's the point. Is okay. We'll hold it here, and we'll see you next time.